Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 132 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Our guest this week is one of the most talented, creative, and thoughtful chefs in the world, that's all, Grant Achatz. I've known Grant since before he became chef owner of Alinea, the Chicago restaurant that has earned just about every national and international accolade available. Many years ago, I had a run of birthdays in which my wife and I visited what were then considered to be Chicago's best restaurants, Charlie Trotter's one year, True the next. Then we hit Trio in Evanston, with its kitchen run by a young alumnus of Thomas Keller's The French Laundry in Napa Valley. Chef Achatz not only had mastered the classic techniques he'd learned, but he was applying them to an imaginative cuisine that was on the cutting edge of molecular gastronomy. One dish was Black Truffle Explosion, which accurately described the sublime sensation that happened in your mouth. Another was an intensely flavored pizza the size and width of a postage stamp. Other courses were more substantial and no less delightful, delicious, or memorable. No offense to Charlie Trotter or the team at True, but Achatz's meal was the one I dreamt about. I went on to interview and write about him many times after that. Entrepreneur Nick Kokonis had a similar reaction to his first encounter with Achatz's food at Trio and wound up partnering with him to build a new restaurant around the chef's vision. Alinea opened May 4th, 2005 in Chicago's Lincoln Park neighborhood and upped the wow factor in terms of flavors, textures, presentation, playfulness, hospitality, and an emotional connection to the food. The following year, Gourmet Magazine deemed Alinea the country's best restaurant. The world's 50 best restaurants also has ranked it as the best restaurant in the U.S. and included it on its international top 50 list multiple times. Elite Traveler has called it the best restaurant in the world. Alinea is currently one of only 13 U.S. restaurants with 3 Michelin stars, an honor it has received every year since the Michelin Guide came to Chicago in 2011. Yet Alinea had been open for a little more than 2 years when, in 2007, Achatz was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer of the tongue. It was a grim diagnosis putting his life at risk and at the very least endangering a part of his body essential to his work. He sought out innovative, aggressive treatment at the University of Chicago Medical Center, and months later he was deemed to be cancer-free and his tongue was saved, even as the radiation took its toll on his voice and in other ways. He tells this story in his 2012 book, Life on the Line, written with Kokonis. When Achatz and I sat down together in his office a few weeks ago, his 50th birthday and Alinea's 19th anniversary were approaching. He has achieved as much as anyone could possibly achieve as he hits these milestones, yet he is creatively restless and looking forward always. This is the chef who, after Alinea marked its 10-year anniversary while atop the culinary world, shut down the restaurant for a 5-month massive renovation that gutted the physical space and rethought every aspect of how the food was prepared and presented. What does Achatz want to change now? How does he wish Alinea could be more like a rock band? Are guests still surprised that he's actually in the kitchen almost every night? Does he still come early to do prep work as well? Has he considered taking more of an executive's role with Alinea, its sister restaurant Next, and the rest of the Alinea group? How does he feel about now being part of the older generation of chefs? How does the younger generation differ from his contemporaries? How much have work expectations and kitchen culture changed since he opened Alinea? How did Alinea, with its emphasis on presentation and creating an experience, pivot so successfully to carry out food during the pandemic? What motivates him now? Achatz was a key part of an international wave of culinary innovation. Is another such wave on the way? I always get a lot from talking with him, and I'm really glad you all get to listen. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Grant Achatz. So it's been almost, so it's really been almost 20 years since I hung out with you and in the kitchen of Trio in the summer of 2004.
Yeah.
Man.
Sometimes that feels like a long time ago, and sometimes it feels like yesterday.
It's funny. I just pulled out a, I was looking through old clips and I found a clip I did the 10-year anniversary of the famous Trio meal that Nick Kokonis had before you guys decided to open Alinea. That was 2014. So that's our, that's like half as long as has passed since.
And
that was like a real, that was a big deal. You got all, everyone to come back for that. And I don't know, like, does that feel like it was sort of the midpoint of to where you are now?
No, no. In fact, I don't, time is really blurry. You know, I think for the last 30 years, for me, it's just been I had no real peripheral in terms of time. Everything was about the kitchen. There was no personal life. There were no milestones or markers, really, outside of the walls of the kitchen that helped you track time. I never celebrated birthdays. Never. I mean, the birth of my children, sure, but once that happened in 01 and 03,
right,
there was nothing after that. Other than that little cancer thing, that was maybe a little blip.
Yeah, the little cancer blip that, you know.
But other than that, like, I've been reflecting a lot lately on time. And, you know, like you mentioned, we're coming up on our 20th anniversary next year. And, you know, I'm about to turn 50.
I was going to ask you that. I know.
And, you know, I always sort of rolled my eyes and scoffed at that midlife, you know, crisis or, oh, you're turning 50. How does it feel? And then it started hitting me.
Yeah.
Lately. And I'm like, wow, I'm 50. That's insane. Because in the kitchen, you measure everything by minutes and seconds. It's not by years. Years and days and weeks, they really don't matter. And so it's really, it sort of jolted me lately. Like,
is
oh
that in
God.
A good way or is that in kind of a uncomfortable way?
Pretty uncomfortable, honestly.
Mm.
Yeah, because you know, you wake up one day and you're like, if I'm lucky, my life's half over. I have, you know, 20 good years left. Yeah. When you start reflecting on what you've done for your adult life, accomplishments, personal goals, or, I mean, it becomes really hard to quantify if you as a person were successful.
Yeah.
You know, and not forget about the restaurant accolades. You as a
Which there
person.
Are there are a lot of accolades there. I mean that's
there's
the
a
thing.
Lot
like,
of accolades.
Like you went into this profession, you opened your own restaurant and you were called the best restaurant in the country like 1 year later.
Yeah.
You know, you've been the chef of the year for the James Beard Awards. You've gotten your 3 Michelin stars. So not to say you peaked early, but you like a lot of those things that people work their entire careers and lives to hit, you hit.
Yeah.
And you hit it in your 30s.
Right.
So like, do you think of your life as sort of like this narrative, like, wait a minute, I peaked then. So now it's kind of harder to come up with challenges, or is it a matter of challenges, or like, what's it about?
Well, I still believe I haven't done my best work. So in my mind, we have yet to peak. I think, you know, when you look at the lifespan of a restaurant like Alinea or French Laundry, per se, Danielle, those legacy restaurants, they're, you can define them in movements in my head.
Right.
And like when we first opened Alinea, we had the formula. We had the team. And everything at that time in 2005, the food that we were doing was brand new. Like, genuinely brand new. So the level of excitement, media attention, guest satisfaction, it was relatively easy, you know? And then, you know, I feel like you go into a period of maintenance. You have to mow the lawn. The grass grew, and then now you have to prune and mow the lawn. And that part's the marathon. And people underestimate, they really underestimate longevity. Like, nobody celebrates longevity.
Well, you have, like, anniversaries, you know? Like, you're going to go to French Laundry's 30th
Especially
anniversary.
Now with social media and everything's instant gratification, right? You hit the like button, you move on. And, you know, when we say that Alinea has been at the forefront of innovative astronomy in the world for 20 years, there are, if you sample 10 food writers, they'll name several other restaurants in the moment right now. And they'll forget about the Alinea's and the French Laundry's and the El Bulli's and the Mooter Eats. And those are gone. And it happens so fast. And people's attention span is so short that sometimes it's really, it's interesting to me to celebrate a plateau. Because people, they celebrate peaks and they celebrate valleys. That's what they, people talk about. Nobody talks about being really good on a consistent level for a really long time. And I find that unusual. This is really, really, really hard to do.
Pre-social media, do you think people would have appreciated the longevity more than they do now?
I think so. I think there's a lot of... So what social media has done is it has provided a platform, an opportunity for people to make opinions about restaurants without ever eating there.
Right.
So you go on Instagram and you look at Alchemist in Copenhagen, or you look at a restaurant in Mexico City that you've never been to, but you look at photos of the food and you read what the chef has to say on that platform, and you make an opinion. That obviously never happened before, you know, 2012 or 11, you know.
And you had a more robust press covering food back then, too. You would have had more newspaper coverage. You would have had more magazines that still existed. And, would you know, more people would have been subscribing to those magazines. So right. There's this whole culture of food writing.
And when you think about food journalism and integrity and, you know, it's a really interesting thing. Because you can have somebody that is... has vast knowledge of astronomy, but they might not be in that position of power in food journalism because maybe they're not that good of a writer. How does that work? So I would rather have Ruth Reichel write about us, even if it was a lukewarm piece, because at the end of the day, her experience and her knowledge about food and about restaurants is the pinnacle. But now there's a lot of people with a lot of opinions that know far less and are more prolific because they have platforms. So it's a really tricky, it's tricky now.
Do you find it harder to get the word out about what you're doing now?
No, because you can just post. But is that the word?
Right.
Right?
Well, in terms of getting people who to come to the restaurant and appreciate your food, right. Which is the main thing.
Look, we're super, super lucky. All of our restaurants are very, very, very busy all the time. When I personally look at Instagram, I don't view it. We've been really lucky to not have to use that as a marketing platform to pull people into our restaurants. We're just trying to show people what we're doing.
Right.
And I say that from purely a creative innovation gastronomic focus. Like, if we come up with a new technique or a new dish or a new service piece, I want to show the world that I put that on Instagram. I'm not putting that up there hoping that a four-top books tonight.
Right.
You know, but it also does have that power. And you can make the most amazing food in the world. If nobody shows up and eats it, you're not going to be making that food for very long.
Right.
You know, so it's an interesting time. And I feel like, you know, with everything, we're in the middle of genres. Like when you look at music or film or art, like painting or photography, there's usually a pretty definitive certain end of a movement, of a style, of a genre. And usually that's 15 to 20 years.
Right.
Obviously the pandemic. So,
sure.
I mean, that moved everybody right back to zero. So like when you think about the styles of gastronomy all over the world prior to the pandemic, that race, if you will, that race of creativity and innovation and establishing genres, being the leading practitioner of this movement, that race had been going on for a very long time. And then all of a sudden it stopped. And nobody knew what the hell was going on. And many, many restaurants closed. Everybody had to adapt. And then when finally you flip the switch back on, the rules of the game are completely different. So everything that you thought you knew, everything that you thought people wanted, the people that you depend on to execute the vision, they're gone. Everything was different. The skill level, the demand for people to work in restaurants like this, the way that people communicate, the guest expectations, the cost of doing business, everything changed. So it's been interesting to try to continue to run the race when all of a sudden somebody points at the group of runners and says, no, no, you can't run forward. You have to turn around and run backwards now.
Right. Well, I mean, a place like Alinea is so, I mean, everything is about the experience of being there,
right,
and having this orchestrated, you know, you're not going to have dinner and then go to the opera. This is the opera. This is the theater. This is like the night's entertainment as well as the nourishment you're going to get for going out.
Right.
And I think that there's sort of been a cultural shift where people understand that more. And the pivot you guys did, which was so brilliant and yet, you know, in a way counterintuitive, was you just went comfort food.
Yeah.
And because you had to come up with stuff that weren't like these, you know, little bites that you were going to experience, or like this, you know, array of things in front of you where you're taking a little of this and then you're experiencing that and then you're going to pull down this thing that's hanging from the ceiling. And instead you were just making comfort food and you totally pivoted and did this other thing under the name Alinea and it worked. And then at some point you had to pivot back to, hey, this is what we do, you know?
Right. I remember sitting on my couch at home on March 15th of 2020 with my laptop on my lap in darkness. And I had a Word document open and I was supposed to be typing the menu, the first to-go menu for Alinea. And I just couldn't get my fingers to push any keys. I didn't know what to do. It was so weird. And Nick called me and he was like, dude, like, we need a menu in 2 days. And I was angry, like everybody was. Angry, confused. And I was like, who is going to want an Alinea meal in a brown paper bag? This is ridiculous. And he was like, we can't do Alinea. And I'm like, well, then what the hell do we do? And he was like, I don't know, cook the food you like to eat. And so that's what we did. And it was pretty much French bistro.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And it worked. I mean, we put out our biggest day. We put out over 2,000 meals out of Alinea alone.
Wow.
So the alderman gave us an extension on our valet zone because we were so busy that the cars were backed up down south past North Avenue. And, you know, people would pull up in brown paper bag, either in their trunk or through the window. And it was insane. But we did it.
I will say that the one thing that sort of made sense to me about it, not that it didn't make sense, but the one thing that I thought was a connection between the pre-pandemic Alinea and this was that your food is always called on these emotions from the past and from growing up, and that you would have something that was very modern, but it would also remind you of what it was like to eat a Reuben or something like that.
Right.
And, you know, you would have like the flavors of something in a different way that was playful, but it also evoked emotions, which was one of the things that I think that when people would sort of talk about molecular gastronomy and kind of sort of group everyone together, until they'd experienced it from you, they would sort of expect, oh, it's going to be like really sciencey. And I'd be like, no, because it's really, because it's really fun and it's actually driven by emotions. And so you going back to cook what you actually love to eat and this comfort food thing, in a way, was consistent with that part of the lineage. It just wasn't consistent with the, you know, having the, the thing in the squid, pulling it out and all that.
Right. No, that's very true. That's very true. And I think that's what made it honest. And that's what makes it linear now. And before the pandemic, that's what makes it, like you're saying, resonate with people, even though it's maybe not recognizable in some cases. When they eat it or smell it or hear it, feel it, there's touchstones there. Like there's familiarity that everybody can sort of hook into. I think that's really important.
I mean, Alinea has always been this, you know, river in the metaphorical sense of, you know, when you would go in at different points, it's going to be a different part of the river no matter what. So, so like March 2019, you know, March 2024, it would have been different regardless of this pandemic that happened in between.
Yeah.
But how is it different because there was a pandemic in between?
I don't think we know yet. Because to be completely honest, like, I don't know how you feel, but in a lot of ways, the pandemic feels like a long time ago, but it's not. And
it doesn't feel a long time ago to me, unfortunately.
The dominoes are still falling. Like, you know, we haven't normalized. And that is on our side and the consumer side, the guest side. Like it's really interesting how people are with expectations, how they define luxury now is different, what time means to them. So I started in preparation to do another Alinea cookbook for the 20th anniversary. I compiled all of the old menus that we've ever had, looking through and finding dishes that I literally forgot about. And in doing that, I came across menus that were 30 courses long, right? And nobody wants to eat like that anymore. I mean, back then, it was like, the more the better. I remember when we first opened, people were having 5.5 hour meals, 6 hour meals. Nobody wants that anymore. And that may come back around, but right now we're still a little bit in the dark. You know, things have to be kind of methodically tested, and we're doing a lot of listening to try to figure out what's next. It's not obvious.
So like how many courses and how long is the, you know, your Alinea meal now? And so, obviously you have like your different, your salon and the gallery and...
Yeah. So the gallery is about 2.5 hours, sometimes 3. And the salon is 1.5 hours. And number of courses, you're talking about 13 in the salon and about 19 in the gallery. So it's still a lot of food.
Right. And some of those are like one bite.
Yeah. Some of those are one bite for sure.
The last time I was here, there was more of something that I'd originally had seen you do at Next, which was that you would have sort of an array of things. So there would be like, you know, a bite of this over here, and there would be like some rocks, and then on that would be like this thing you would eat.
Right.
And so instead of having as many sequential 19 things, it was more like, okay, here's 4 is a part of this one.
So that was a very conscious choice in menu flow. Experience, like you mentioned, when we first opened, everything was singular.
Right.
You know, they're all strung together, but The idea was that you focus on one item in front of you, you consumed it, you gave it all your attention, and then it was gone.
And everyone at the table had the same thing.
Right. And it was a very, very linear, vertical, straight up and down type situation. And then when we reopened after the renovation, after 10 years, we did the opposite. The line, instead of really narrow and long, we made it very thick. We got wide. So, you know, we call those sidecars. So you would have your main plate, and then you would have one or sometimes five additional complementary small forces that landed at the same time. And they're all cohesive, but it was like a mini story.
Right.
You know, like a paragraph, essentially. Yeah.
So are you still doing that then, or have you moved back to the more vertical?
We're slowly moving back to the thin line, where you're hyper-focused on one thing. We still have a little bit here and there. But, you know, I mean, that, you know, you're always limited with the container that you're in. So, like, at the end of the day, we're a restaurant. And with that comes a lot of rules and a lot of things that you just can't change. And I feel like for us, the real burst of the next movement will have to involve a different container, if that made sense. Like, you know, Alinea's a beautiful restaurant. Two floors, four dining rooms. The kitchen's never going to move. The layout of the restaurant's never going to change. Those walls, you're not going to move walls. Like, sure, we can move some interior walls, but for the most part, you have a big rectangle. And
double-decker rectangle.
Yeah, and within that, like, there's always, you have to have tables, you have to have service stations, you have to have X amount of space between the tables. So, like, it's a math problem that you just can't change unless you find a new address or the ability to really, really break this. But then the finances are all messed up.
So you're looking for a new address?
We're always looking for a new address. I said, I think it was 2007 at Madrid Fusion. I was on stage giving a presentation. And at the very end, there was a Q&A. And somebody said, what's the next thing for restaurants? And I said, why does a restaurant need to have a permanent address? Why can't we go on tour like a rock band?
Hmm.
And lo and behold, now that is not so uncommon. Noma was in Tulum, they're in Tokyo. People are doing pop-ups all over the world, right? And with that comes a whole set of variables that influence the experience. Locality, ingredients, the clientele. You know, I mean, if you talk about being a creative and responding to your environment, your stimuli, then you have to move. You have to move around. Like, that was the other thing that the pandemic really hurt. And you and I have talked about this before. Travel for inspiration. Like, I would travel a lot. I would be in Japan once a year, a couple of times in Spain each year, going to other restaurants, being aware of other cultures and other cuisines. And, you know, that essentially stopped for 3 years.
Right.
So where do you draw your inspiration then? You know,
if you were getting a new address, what would you want a new space to do that you can't do here?
Well, I would want it to be temporary.
Okay. So it's not a matter of like the layout. It's not like I want it to be one story or three stories, or I want it to have like wide open spaces or bigger ceilings or windows. You just want it to be something that you're not stuck at.
I want to respond to a problem. Some of our best work that we've ever done has been when adversity was right in front of us, and we didn't know what to do. Like when we did the pop-up in Madrid and Miami, when we were doing the 10-year renovation here, and we closed for 4 months, those spaces were far less than ideal to create in Alinea. But that's what made it so cool, is that we didn't have all of our comfort, and we had to respond to a smaller dining room, the lack of a kitchen, outdoor areas, you know, and all of those things. That's what produces creativity.
Right.
You know?
And Alinea was never been defined as like a farm to table restaurant. But if you're in Madrid or Miami, also depending on what time of the year you are, you're going to certainly get different stuff to work with than you do in Chicago in February.
Yeah. And we put, like, when we were in Madrid, we paid homage to Spanish gastronomy and culture. So not that we were obligated to, because everybody was very excited to have Alinea in Madrid. It wasn't like we were bringing sand to the beach, but we wanted to have those touchstones, and we wanted to create new stuff for a new audience with new ingredients and a new culture.
So if you could, would you just travel a lot more with Alinea?
Yeah, absolutely.
You just go on tour the way U2 was on tour. Although U2, they just went and set up so they're doing the opposite. They like they put their restaurant in Las Vegas for a while. Right. And they want to go on the road like, you know, U2 touring the different venues.
Yeah, I mean, if you had the ability to have a traveling Alinea that minimum 4 months, you know, 4 to 6 months in each location, that would be incredible.
Hmm.
Right?
And then you come back here every once in a while to do a hometown show.
Yeah.
Set up here for 4 months, go somewhere else for
you could do
four locations a year, 3 months in each. One of them would be here.
I can't even imagine how much more prolific we would be. Like we haven't stopped since Trio. Right, with new dishes. And, you know, we're putting a new dish on today. And it just never stops.
And what is it?
It's a caviar dish with cantaloupe, chamomile, tea, and egg yolk. But if you were traveling and you had all of that stimuli, and let's say you were in Tokyo and you discovered a new technique or a new ingredient, then you bring that with you to Mexico City,
right.
And then you bring it to LA, and then you bring it to New York, and then, you know, wherever. I mean, that would be amazing.
Caropop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Now that spring truly has arrived, Revolution's premium lager, Cold Time, really hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's never pasteurized, and the brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a slower, lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. Cold Time is available in 12 packs of 12-ounce cans. Is there a direction you would say your food has gone in the last, I don't know, 10 years, you know, where you were here, then you were here, now I'm pushing in this other area that I hadn't pushed in before?
I would say that we're simpler, a little bit more minimalist. I would say when we first opened in 2005, we were trying to highlight and show a fair bit of the bells and whistles of molecular gastronomy. Like, it was important for us to put it right in front of your face and show you. That's taken a backseat. We're still using all of those techniques. It's just not readily visually apparent. So I would say our style of plating the food is a bit different, less complicated, less busy, I would say.
Is there less manipulation to a lot of ingredients per dish?
there's a lot less components per plate.
Right.
So I think just that alone means there's less manipulation, you know. The toolbox is still the toolbox. Like, we use all the stuff. It's just less, I want to say garish, but it's just less in your face.
What was the last dish you created that really got you excited?
I don't know. To find excited. Like, there's levels of, like, when you talk about, like, the explosion or the hot potato or the balloon or the tabletop dessert, like, there's a group of about 10 of those that are, like, I mean, those are massive hits. You knew it before the dish was even done. Like, as soon as the idea was there, you're like, oh, man, this is going to be huge. Like, this is a disruptor. This is a game changer for sure.
Well, and when you were at Trio, you had the black truffle explosion and you had the mozzarella balloons. And you're like, we're not going to repeat any of it at Alinea.
Right.
And then you came up with hot potato, cold potato. So I was like, all right, we got a new hit for the new place.
Yeah.
Among many at that
right. But like now I get excited in different ways. The smaller victories, the incremental refinements mean more to me now than they did back then. Back then we would rush. It was all a race, right? And we had to do it before Moto did it or El Bulli did it or WD-50 did it, and we would rush something onto the menu for the sake of putting that timestamp on it.
Right.
You know? And now I'm fine. Like, they'll laugh at me in the kitchen all the time. I'm like, no, it's not quite ready. It's really, really cool, but we're not quite there yet. And that maturity is something that surprises me a little bit, because I'm still fanatically beholden to constant innovation and what's new. But I guess as I age, you know, as I mature, so does the food.
Well, and there were so many techniques that were really young at the time and that you were really getting the most out of.
Mm-hmm.
Are you able to keep finding new techniques to have those, you know, new, you know, blow your mind innovations all the time? Or at some point does it like, okay, this is the toolbox, but the toolbox isn't getting that many new tools every year like it was in 2005?
It's certainly not. I think everybody can agree with that. But how do you explain this? Because molecular gastronomy had that title, that descriptor, all of the new use of hydrofoils and foams and all of that gelation stuff, everybody just focused on that. And so if I discovered a plant that the leaf tasted like oysters, back then, that wasn't innovative. You just found a plant. Right? You didn't foam anything. You didn't smoke anything. You didn't create a new service piece. That's not innovation. But now I look at it and I'm like, of course that's innovative. You know? So like, does it have to be through the lens of science in order for it to be new and creative?
Right.
Right. To me, it's more about the experience now. Like, I would say before, I would hyper-focus on an event. I would look at the course in a menu like an event, like a firecracker going off. I wouldn't be as conscious of writing the play and what it meant to sit there and watch that play.
You're more about the set pieces than the arc of the story.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a good way to put it. Yeah.
I mean, early Alinea Mach 1, as you were describing, you had these vertical meals and each table was getting served based on when they came in. So the people over there would be, you know, they'd be, you know, marveling at this thing they had. And then you'd kind of be looking over there going, oh, I guess I'm going to get that one too.
Mm-hmm.
Later in Mach 2, like in the gallery, you had all the tables getting everything at the same time.
Yeah.
So you were sort of orchestrating this group experience.
Right.
Are you still doing that now? And how important is it to orchestrate the experience for anyone, but also to make it a group experience?
Well, I mean, it gives us a lot more creative freedom to move everyone at the same time. I mean, the best analogy is like, if you go see Hamilton and the play starts, imagine if people just showed up when they want and came in and sat down. Like, that would be super weird. People would only see half the play. People would disrupt the other people. Like, to have that continuity where we have complete control over the environment, the lighting, the sound, the smells, everything about it, that to me is, that's powerful. But even then, we don't. Because, like, back to what I was saying before, we're a restaurant. We're not Steppenwolf. Like, we don't have theater lighting. We don't have actors that come in and play a role. We have to have tables and chairs, and we have to have X amount of people a night. So when we start talking about, like, creative desires, I want to strip away as much of the restaurant from the restaurant as we possibly can and just tell the story.
Seems like there are people who want to give themselves up to that. And then there are people who, and this was like a while ago, I remember there was a spate of like sort of anti-tasting menu pieces where like, I want to choose with my experience. I don't want to choose. Like where are people on that now? Do you feel like they're, are they more willing still to let themselves go? Because that's why you come here, is to have like your experience.
Yeah.
Or are people resistant? Like, you know what? If I want you to deep fry this, whatever, you're going to do it the way I want to do it.
We don't have much of that. We're very fortunate where I would say 99.9% of the people that book their reservation 2 months in advance and pay for it in advance have done at least a little bit of research on what they're going to do.
The beauty of having a reputation is that you have a reputation.
Right. Every once in a while, we get some people that disagree with the experience, but it doesn't happen very often. Yeah.
And are you still here most nights?
I am, yeah. People are consistently surprised by that.
I remember years ago you telling me this. You're like, people are like, you know, they don't think I'm going to be here.
Right. Yeah, I mean, for a lot of reasons, I think. Like I said before, I feel like we have yet to do our best work. So that in of itself, for somebody that has a personality like I do, is always looking around the corner for that new thing, right? I like it. I like being here.
Mm.
I mean, you know, I have backed off a little bit, I would say. So the amount of 16-hour days are far less than I used to. That used to be the norm. But I'm still here 14 hours a day, almost 5 days a week.
Yeah.
And if I'm not here, I'm down at Nats or Aviary or Royster.
Yeah, I was gonna ask if you're sure. Yeah, I think that people have this idea that when you become a big chef that you just oversee your empire and sort of pop in every once in a while, but you're not actually in the kitchen. But the thing you like about it is being in the kitchen.
Yeah. But also there is room for that. And I think as we move forward, when I start talking about doing our best work, potentially trying to figure out a way to take this on the road and to be the most prolific, there is a point that I have my eye on that I will transition more into a creative director type role. Right now I'm here somewhere between 7 and 9 in the morning over a cutting board. And then I'm here through prepping in the service well into, you know, 9, 10, 11, midnight every day.
You making people's desserts on their table still?
That's right. Yeah, for sure. And that obligation of prep and service it hinders creativity. There's only so many hours in the day. So here's what used to happen. Like, I would do that schedule at Trio, and here, for years and years and years, but the difference is the creative time came at night when everybody left. So I would get here at 9 a.m., I would prep, we would go into service until midnight. By 1 a.m., everybody was gone, and I would go sit down in the dining room by myself until 4 a.m., and that's when I would write out the dishes. I'm married now. I'm 50. I can't be here till 4 a.m. every night.
Right. That's a long...
I would not be married very long. So what are those hours? If we're going to uphold our commitment to continue to innovate, I need those 4 hours back somehow.
Right. Do you have to do the chopping?
No, but I like it.
See? Okay.
You know what I mean?
Because most people will be like, well, why are you shopping?
Right. Right. And the people that are surprised that I'm here, they're also right. Because most chefs aren't. Like, once you reach a certain level of success and you've built a team behind you, most aren't.
Right.
You know?
Well, what's the labor situation like these days? It's sort of two levels, I would imagine. You know, one would be just getting those skilled people to come in who can really, you know, add to the creative life of your restaurant.
Yeah.
And then there would just be your basic, you need people to do this job, and this job just to make sure the dishes are clean and guests are eating seated and all of that.
Right. So obviously post-pandemic, first of all, nobody wanted to work. So we went through that phase where it was a desert. Like, there was no pipeline coming in for anyone, front and back of the house. And then there was a big influx of career changers. So non-hospitality professionals were applying in, like, mass quantities. People that were accountants and lawyers and real estate people that were like, during the pandemic, they had a life change. And they're like, you know what? Life is short. It's very unpredictable. I've always loved cooking. I hate my current job. I'm going to change careers.
And I'm going to go try to work at the best restaurant in the country.
And so that happened. and while that was happening, culturally, there was a massive upheaval. So we ended up raising our comp packages by almost 30% across the board. So people demanded significantly more money. They wanted to work significantly less hours. And for the most part, they were far, far less skilled and experienced. And so ultimately, you end up as an operator, you end up with a situation where you need almost twice as many people to do the same job, and you have to pay them 30% more.
All while there's food inflation and everything.
And cost of goods. But also, people became more price sensitive. So everybody in the world knows how much a dozen eggs cost now. Everybody complains about it. Everybody's on TikTok, right? Complaining about how everything costs more. But when they come to the restaurant, you can't raise your prices. No way. Well, why not? Like, you all know everything, the inflation that's happening. But it doesn't matter. There's a threshold, right, with food. It's really interesting.
Have you actually struggled as a business to be viable with all these forces, or is it basically you're still at a level that you can get through it even if, you know, others maybe could not?
Again, we're very lucky that we have high demand. So, you know, are the margins as good as they were pre-pandemic? No, absolutely not. But you have to adapt, and you have to, that's part of the problem. You have to figure it out, you know?
You haven't felt like you have to sort of cut corners on ingredients that you're using or any of that stuff?
No.
Scale it back a little bit.
Definitely not products. But what's interesting that came with this is the workforce made the decision, this younger generation in their prioritization of work-life balance, they would happily work less and make less as an annual, right? So we have to pay them more per hour, but they only want to work 8 hours. They don't want any overtime. They want to go home. So in that way, it gave us an opportunity to, it put more pressure on management because the amount of employees increased to get the same amount of output.
Right.
So you had to train more people. And that sharing of information is hard in a restaurant like Alinea that is open 7 days a week. So you have this constant churning of new people, but there's creative ways to manage that.
Do you keep your eyes open for the people who want to work here at 16-hour days because they just really want to get...
I mean,
I assume you must still find some of those.
Yeah, we do. And those are the people that ultimately stay and become managers and have longevity. You know, we have the GM of Alinea celebrated his 10th anniversary a couple of days ago. We have three people that have been here since day one. Mm. A lot of 12, 15-year people. So that part's really rewarding. I never thought it would be, but it really is. I remember being at the French Laundry and listening to Chef Keller talk about loyalty and people that have been with him for years and years and years. And I always thought, okay, sure. But again, now I'm like, wow, that's powerful. You know, that's really powerful.
I mean, when I got to know you, you were, you know, young sort of wunderkind chef, and, you know, you had Chef Keller, who was a mentor, and, you know, you had Charlie Trotter, who was sort of the old guard, you know, trying to keep the young guard away. Man. At some point, did you sort of, I mean, as you approached your 50th birthday, but I assume before then, was there a point where you thought, oh, I'm not that anymore? Now they're like these young chefs I just saw, they're where I was, and I've sort of moved up to the next level, and I'm not sure how I feel about that.
So it's really interesting. I was having a conversation the other day about this, and what I realized is when I worked for Chef Trotter and Chef Keller, they were old enough to be my father. Hmm. Right? So there was a 20-year span in our ages there. When I opened Alinea and we had John Shields, Curtis Duffy, David Posey, Alex Stupak, Jordan Kahn, Dave Barron, that whole team, we were all the same age. So there's something about that where the authoritative figure, the boss, the chef, is the exact same age as you, and you're taking orders from them. It's very different than if they're 20 years older than you. So now you fast forward almost 20 years, and we're all 50. But now I'm 50, and if you walk in the kitchen, most of them are in their mid-20s. So now they're looking at me like, oh, chef should be my dad.
Right.
Right? And that, the way you communicate with them, the way they listen, to be relatable to them is very, very different. And it makes a big impact on how you see yourself and how they view you. It's interesting.
Are you consciously trying to sort of nurture them as opposed to seeing them as threats like some certain chefs did?
Definitely not threats.
Yeah, that's not your personality.
In the nurturing, the mentoring, it's really interesting. The younger generation, what they prioritize and how they assimilate information, what is important to them is really very different than it was for me. You know, they want a lot of explanation. They want a lot of demos. They want precise black and white communication. And when I was in the French Laundry kitchen, it was kind of the opposite. The less amount you talked, the fewer questions you ask, the better. You did it all by observing and watching, you know? And so it's frustrating at times, you know, I catch myself, I'm like, how do they not know? Like, they watched me do that for 3 hours. How do they not know? Hmm. And that is just not the way. So when we talk about, you know, me at 50, still over a cutting board, when Chef Keller was doing that, that was his way of communicating to the entire kitchen.
Right.
And that's why I bought the exact same knife that he had, the knife brand. That's the way I tied my apron that way. That's the way I stood that way. I bought the same frogs as him. He was leading by example, not by communicating verbally. And now it's all about verbal and demos. And
so you try to lead the way Chef Keller did, but then there's like, well, can't you just tell me?
Yeah. And tell me many times and very clearly. And so that's a whole different skill set. And it really disrupts time in the kitchen too. You know, it really has, if the way Chef used to do it at the laundry, if he was explaining something by doing it and you were watching him, he was getting something done while he was communicating how to do it to you. Now you have to stop what you're doing and explain it and then show and then watch and supervise to make sure it's being done right. It's just a very different.
It's interesting.
Yeah, it's very different.
I mean, I remember being in the kitchen early on, you know, not long after you opened and probably even before you opened. And, you know, a few times, other times, you know, I was just sort of back there when everyone was working. And what I remember is it was always very quiet. It
yeah.
was like this kind of like quiet, you know, well-oiled machine. And everyone seemed to know where they were. But it was like this intricate dance being done pretty quietly.
Yeah.
Like certainly none of the yelling, plate throwing kind of stuff.
No,
but also just even in terms of, you know, like, just your communication, anyone, everything was very low key. Would you say is the volume different now?
I don't think the volume, and maybe it's a little bit louder, but like the purpose of movement is a little bit different. I feel like back then, as soon as you walked in the back door, in your head, you had already written the script for the day. Like, you knew your next five moves before you got to number two. And that methodical, organized approach is something that we are now having to teach. It is not intuitive for this group of culinarians, I would say.
Now, is that because of the other ones had more training or just a generational mindset?
Yeah, I think it's generational mindset because convenience has changed right now. Grocery comes right to your door. Uber comes right to your curb. Everything's on your phone. Like, everything's just instant and accessible. And with that, eliminates a lot of decision-making and a lot of premeditated thought about how to accomplish a day. How am I successful today? Like, we tell them, like, you have to look at your entire day before you walk in and organize it in a way that prioritizes things in a meaningful manner in order for you to get everything done and done well. And this generation is just not used to that.
Hmm.
They're used to pushing buttons. Stuff just comes to them, you know?
Do you have to tell people you have to put away your phone while you're working here? You can't. It's a serious thing. I mean, look, as a father with two kids, you know, it's like the phone at the dinner table is like something we've had to, you know, inform. I mean, they're both in school now.
Here's the thing, though, too, is like now in the digital world, all of our recipes are digitized. And so that's how they reference them, like a Google Doc or whatever, right? So all day long, everybody has their phone out, looking at recipes or looking at Instagram. You don't really know.
Right.
So it's hard to discipline in that way, you know.
Do you keep up with the chefs who, you know, used to work with you? I mean, like John Shields just got his third Michelin star over at Smith, and Curtis Duffy had it at Grace and is still, you know, working at a high level at Ever.
Yeah.
Do you sort of check out what they're up to, and do you guys get ideas from each other still?
I mean, we're all so busy.
Right.
We don't necessarily hang out. We communicate all the time, usually on Instagram. Right. But yeah, I'm close with John. I'm close with Jordan Kahn at Vespertine and Dave Barron. And we all stay in touch. And that's become more and more important to me as time goes on, too. Like, I don't know if you noticed when we were walking through the kitchen just now, but there's plaques that we hang in the kitchen memorizing the executive chefs that work here.
Oh, nice.
So we have their start date and their end date and their name and that sort of thing. You know, for me now, it's about how do we build this into a legacy? How would 20 years? I mean, that's a very long time in restaurant lifetimes. And there's no indication that we're going anywhere. So
except on the road.
Except on the road, right. So how do you build that? How do you nurture that? How do you prioritize that? That's what's going through my head now.
Yeah, I mean, Trotter closed at 25 years, and it doesn't
was
sound
it
25? Like it was 25, yeah.
Was it?
So yeah, you got 5 more years.
Damn.
Then you're going to pass them. Then you can pass them.
Right.
But it doesn't sound like you're sort of on the, you know, 5 years and I'm out. 55, no. That's enough. I'm going to go, you know, hang out.
My life will change. But definitely not going to be done. It's way too much to do. I mean, we have, the Olivia book was put out in 08, so much material that hasn't been published. And that says 41 menus.
Wow.
Oh, that IP, never been published. So that could be a series of books forever, right? There's a lot to do. There's still a lot to do.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I was Googling myself and you just to see, you know, what pieces I wrote at the Trib.
Uh-huh.
And I found one that was published March 20th, 2014.
Okay.
And it was you talking with Fran Adria of El Bulli and Andoni Luis Aduriz of Muguritz.
Yeah.
And it was the three of you just talking. And I sort of printed this, like, I just asked the three of you questions and we had like a little round table. And I asked, what does each of you learn the most from each other? And you had said, for me, it's having the opportunity to be part of gastronomy at a time when it is at its most creative. And then you sort of went on, mm-hmm. You said, whether it be music or painting, you go through long periods of a plateau, but it's very rare that you're in the moment where you're part of or being influenced by something so significant.
Mm-hmm.
Like 20 years ago, people were cooking all the same for the most part, but then along comes the shift and the super creative moment where it fuels all the young cooks that were influenced by it, and it changes gastronomy significantly. It's really awesome to be part of that period and to get confidence watching people be so successful at taking risks and literally changing a field.
Mm.
So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you're still in that moment 10 years later?
No, I feel like we're on the cusp of that.
The cusp of another one.
Yeah.
So what's that going to look like?
I'm not sure yet, but we have to. None of us are satisfied, and that's a good thing.
Right?
Yeah.
No complacency here.
No complacency, and we have more resources than we've ever had. I mean, the Alinea brand opens up doors all over the world. I would consider ourselves lazy if we didn't do something significant in the near future.
Where do you think that's going to come in terms of, is it going to be like another sort of technological advance, or is it going to be sort of an experiential advance where you just change the way people experience what you're doing?
Experiential for sure. Yeah. I mean, it might involve some technology. In fact, it certainly will. But yeah, it has to be the experience.
Is there something that you feel like is lacking that you'd like to be part of the experience?
Oh, so much. When you look at movies and you like look at the production budget of whatever, Dune, right? I get so jealous.
Hmm.
You know, not the dollars, but the freedom. Like, there isn't really anything in Hollywood that can't be accomplished now with CGI, special effects. Like, whatever you can dream, you can pretty much put it on that screen. That's what I want to be able to have in terms of freedom with a restaurant experience.
So what are you dreaming that you can't put on the restaurant screen right now?
Environment. You know, I made the analogy about Steppenwolf, but like, Alinea should do dinner on stage at Steppenwolf for a month. That should be the play, right?
You wouldn't have to take it that far on the road if you did that.
Right. Okay, Broadway.
So would it be kind of like the Rick Bayless thing where you'd be like dancing and acting and stuff?
I'm not so sure I'd be dancing. Nobody wants to see me dance, but I'd be cooking. Imagine if it were a real cooking production on stage. What if it was The Bear live on stage and the people in the audience also got to taste the food?
What do you think of that show?
I haven't watched a whole lot of it. I don't watch much TV. But what I have saw, it was probably 4 episodes, maybe. It's really well done. Like,
and the second season's different from the first. So if you watch just the first, you should.
I did watch only the first.
Because the first season, he's still kind of working within Mr. Beef, basically.
Okay.
And the second season, he's trying to turn it into Alinea. So
okay,
it's an interesting, like, he's trying to get into fine dining overtly, as opposed to putting funky things on the menu of a Italian beef place.
Got it. Word on the street is they're writing Alinea heavily into the season that they're filming now. There's some story arc where somebody works here, and then I don't know.
Are they trying to get here in the third season?
Not yet.
All right. Well, yeah, they got it. You got to do a cameo.
Yeah.
All right. This is awesome talking to you again.
Yeah.
You have any like
awesome.
That's all for episode 132 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Grant Achatz, not only for sharing his insights about all he has contributed to the culinary arts, but also for being an inspiration and pushing one's creativity, regardless of what you've already accomplished. If you're interested in making a reservation at Alinea, regardless of whether you live in the Chicago area, go to aliniarestaurant.com. Next, Achatz's West Loop restaurant that prepares 3 thematic menus a year is just beginning its Bobby Flay menu, to be followed in September by one spotlighting the cuisine of Achatz's one-time employer, the late Charlie Trotter. Go to nextrestaurant.com for more information and reservations, and go to the aliniagroup.com to learn more about the Aviary, the Office, Royster, and the St. Clair Supper Club. The Alinea Group also is on Instagram. Achatz's 2012 book, Life on the Line, remains widely available in the Alinea Cookbook, the Aviary Cocktail Book, the Non-Alcoholic Drink Book, Zero, and the Office Classic Cocktail Book make for very nice gifts. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Wake, who deserves 3 Michelin stars for his preparation of sound bites.
Let's talk more about Chris.
For a mere $24, you can become a Carol Pop friend and help keep this thing going. Please contribute at carolpop.com. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at Carol Popcast. And you can follow me as well at Mark Caro, at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop conversation. Thanks.